Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Biden's first policy press conference since being inaugurated president yesterday. Much ado about a nice read-through. Biden wasn't the only one who was scripted. D.C. press corps dutifully played their role to prop up Joe Biden as much as possible. Very generous questioning, to the extent it was questioning and not just prompting talking points from reporters. The topic that was dominant really clearly was border security. And this is how the first question from some leftist NPR reporter, I repeat myself, on border security went.
Well, look, I guess I should be flattered. People are coming because I'm the nice guy. That's the reason why it's happening, that I'm a decent man or however it's phrased, that, you know, that's why they're coming, because no, Biden's a good guy. Truth of the matter is, nothing has changed. As many people came, 28% increase in children to the border in my administration, 31%. In the last year of in 2019, before the pandemic, in the Trump administration. It happens every single solitary year. There is a significant increase in the number of people coming to the border in the winter months of January, February, March. It happens every year. In addition to that, there is a — and nobody — and by the way, does anybody suggest that there was a 31% increase under Trump because he was a nice guy and he was doing good things at the border? That's not the reason they're coming. The reason they're coming is that it's the time they can travel with the least likelihood of dying on the way because of the heat in the desert, yeah. Number one. Number two, they're coming because of the circumstances in country. In country. The way to deal with this problem, and I started to deal with it back when I was United States Senator, Vice President, putting together a bipartisan plan of over $700 million to do with the root causes of why people are leaving. What did Trump do? He eliminated that funding. He didn't use it. He didn't do it.
See, there's nothing to see here. This is just like the swallows to Capistrano. This is just something that's seasonal. Yeah, it's no big deal.
The weather.
Previous administrations have had to deal with it. I'm having to deal with it, and we're dealing with it. Problem is, and of course, you don't get a follow-up here because one of the systemic failures of the D.C. press corps and the press, political press in general, is they don't listen to answers.
No, yeah.
And so they just follow up with prompts for more talking points rather than something that's relevant. For example, challenging the premises of Biden's statement. And they have no institutional knowledge. And they also have no real working knowledge of the policy areas they cover. So it's a real trifecta of incompetence and contrivance from the D.C. press corps. It's the same thing that happened under Trump, really. Well, in February, there was 3x the number of people apprehended at the border than there were during the Trump administration. Is that because the Biden ICE and CBP under the Biden administration is more aggressive than it was under the Trump administration? No, of course not. It's not true.
No, it's people that are coming here illegally are even telling reporters like Martha Raddatz and others, I'm here because of Biden. As soon as Biden won the election, they packed their bags. They got their money together to get the, you know, coyotes to take them across the Rio Grande. Well, I mean, this was a disgrace. I almost felt physically ill after watching this. Oh, Dan, the man is, he's, that dementia, he's got Alzheimer's. It reminded me of Reagan in his later years.
How's that?
just be, not being, he's mentally, his faculties are gone.
Well, that wasn't Reagan in his, I mean, Reagan in his later years when he,
no, after his presidency. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's true.
I mean, how could they let this happen? If anybody, you're telling me 80 million people voted for this guy? 312-642-5600, Turnkey Depro answer line.
Well, with respect to the statements he made on the border, it's not just the migrants that are saying it. And by the way, the question that was asked of that leftist NPR reporter, I repeat myself, they're coming here because you're such a good guy, you're such a decent man. And then he sort of repeats it, but then saying then goes on to say, well, why, here's why they're really coming. Socialist Mexican president, AMLO, Andres Manuel López Obrador, expectations were created that with the government of President Biden, there would be better treatment of migrants, and this has caused Central American migrants and also from our country wanting to cross the border, thinking that it's easier to do so. People don't go to the United States for fun. They go out of necessity. They see Biden as the migrant president and see, and so many feel they're going to reach the United States. Is AMLO doing Trump's bidding too? Is this, are all of the migrants, the Mexican president, the other presidents we've heard from Central America, like the president of El Salvador, who doesn't appreciate the no, come, but don't come. But if you come, you're not going to go back. Wink and a nod from the Biden administration. They're all part of the vast right wing conspiracy. The facilitating the lying is the worst part of that press conference. I know people are going to focus on his mental acuity. That is the least interesting part of that press conference, the least important part. The most important part is the lying and the press suborning, lying to the American people, not challenging the fabulous, noted storytelling on issues.
Well, I said, you know, I'm a nice guy. I'm a practical guy. He said that all the time. And they fed into that ego. But Trump, whatever you say about it, he never handpicked questions from prearranged reporters. Obviously, Peter Ducey was there ready to go. They didn't pick him. I knew before the press conference started. And the way they laid it out, they only allowed 25 reporters in. They took questions from 10 reporters. And the ones that they liked, that reminds me of a communist country. That actually reminds me of what happens here in Illinois.
Yeah.
Except, they pick the questions they want from the people they like.
Except other than Steve Ducey, it doesn't matter who they pick. Does it? I'm asking
and then
a question.
All the report, well,
since you're lodging a grievance, why don't you answer that? Other than Steve Ducey, it doesn't matter who he calls on in the D.C. press corps. It is all the same.
It was all they were talking to him like, Mr. Biden, how do you feel? Are you going to run again? And they were treating him like he was a senile, doddering old fool. It was a disgrace. Listen.
So I'm going to say something outrageous.
Sorry, that's not it.
For re-election.
I said that is my expectation.
This is about re-election.
So is that a yes that you are running for re-election?
Listen to
look, I don't know where you guys come from, man. I've never been able to travel. I'm a great respecter of fate. I've never been able to plan 3.5 years ahead for certain.
And if you do run, will Vice President Harris be on your ticket?
I would fully expect that to be the case. She's doing a great job. She's a great partner. She's a great partner.
And do you believe you'll be running against former President Trump?
Oh, come on. I don't even think about it. I have no idea. I have no idea whether it'll be a Republican Party.
Not going to be a Republican
Party. Do you?
Party.
I know you don't have to answer my question, but I mean, you know, do you? I mean, look, this is
such an embarrassment. And those reporters all in that room, you could feel the tension. I mean, they knew that they were dealing with a senile person who should not be up there right now answering questions. The way they acted, you think she ever talked to President Trump that way? No.
I completely disagree. And all of this obsession with Biden's alleged senility, I mean, I just don't know and understand where it goes. They treated President Biden the same way they treated President Obama. Was President Obama senile? Were the softballs that were lobbed in President Biden's direction any different than the softballs lobbed in the direction of President Obama? Speaking of the lack of institutional knowledge, one of my grievances that I document routinely. This is something new? No. And for the most part, Biden stuck to his script for the hour-long press conference.
Which he had right in front of him.
And so did the D.C. press corps. But you don't come away with the point here is to focus on that he was scripted, and that the focus is on that he was scripted to tell you lies on policy issue after policy issue that matter to your life. Take their bait every time, please. Take the left's bait every single time. Focus on what they want you to focus on rather than what you should focus on, which is your lives. The material impact of these positions on your lives. Jim in Portage Park. John in Portage Park, I'm sorry.
Good morning. I just wanted to see if you noticed that he picked on Yamiche Alcindor and the Asian woman and the Latin woman and hey guys, man, and there's something really politically not correct about that. And he was just a disgrace, and you know, China's watching and North Korea's watching, and he's just weak. And I think that's just a disgrace for America.
He didn't
America.
Even know who he was choosing. How do you not even know the people in the press corps? He had to like up next. Cecilia Vega? Yeah, she works at ABC News. He doesn't even watch the news. He doesn't even know what's going on. He didn't even know where he was.
I totally disagree. There's just no evidence to support that. That is mindless.
He didn't know where he was.
He didn't know where he was. He gave an hour long press conference full of answers.
All right, fine. He knew where he was. He didn't know who he was talking to. I mean, come on. Oh my God. Has he not watched the past 8 years? Does he not know? Kristen Welker works at NBC. Caitlin works at CNN.
Who cares?
And then he walked off stage. Well, the reporter from Univision's asking him a question.
So? Presidents walk off the dais all the time when reporters continue asking questions.
I'm sure somebody's talking in his ear saying it, press conference.
I'm sure
over.
You are.
And she did a follow-up, and he just...
So what?
And walked on.
So what? You have press flags that say, okay, we're done here, and then... Politicians walk away from the podium all the time. I'm not going to indulge this. He doesn't know where he is. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's senile. He's out of it. I'm not going to indulge it. You can make the argument. Go ahead, make it.
Okay.
Here we go.
So I'm going to say something outrageous. I have never been particularly poor at calculating how to get things done in the United States Senate. So the best way to get something done, if it holds near and dear to you that you like to be able to, anyway, we're going to get a lot done. And if we have to, if there's complete lockdown and chaos as a consequence of the filibuster, then we'll have to go beyond what I'm talking about.
Hey, look at your notes now.
Okay, hang on. Sorry. Oh, same name, Miss Kim.
Same name, Miss Kim.
So?
That doesn't scare you that guy has the nuclear codes?
Because why? Because he answered four questions or so, five questions on the filibuster. It's pretty clear what his position was to me. We'll get to it. Because he started a thought, then he stopped it and went to the next reporter. Have you ever seen, did President Trump ever stumble over his words? Did he ever misspeak that made him senile? Was he not competent? Should we go back and pull Trump loopers and then you can pick that one out of an hour and say he was senile? He didn't have the mental acuity for the job?
Trump was senile.
Exactly. You know,
I have a family member who has Alzheimer's, and it reminded me of trying to have a conversation with him.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. The press seemed to have conversation with him for an hour, and he answered questions on point. Filibuster question? He talked about the filibuster. The border? He talked about the border. Tax cuts? He gave his propaganda on tax increases. I should say he gave us propaganda tax increases. It's so cheap. And you're taking the bait of the left, if that's what you want to focus upon. So cheap.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Before we leave the Biden press conference on the topic of immigration and border security, it is worth checking out what people at the border have to say. I know there's focus on the politicians and there's focus on the migrants. How about Americans? Remember them? Well, Bill Hemmer and Dana Perino at Fox did, and they spoke with a Texas rancher named John Sewell, who's about 40 miles north of the border, so not right on the border. And here's what he's saying, somebody who has 25 years of perspective in dealing with this on the ground, unlike most of the politicians in D.C.
Well, it's been certainly a lot different than I've ever seen it. I've been here about 25 years, so I've seen, under many, many administrations, I've seen lots of trouble. But I've never seen it at this level. And I've never seen it with this quality of people. You know, there's still people coming through that really are coming to better themselves and better their lives. But I think that the dynamics have changed of that today. It's not the same group of folks that I'm used to seeing. Well, they're more confrontational. They have something to lose. I don't know if it's because of human smuggling. You know, my problem is I'm 40 miles from the border. So it's not like I'm sitting on the edge of the border and all these people are coming across the river to me. The only reason I can attribute my problems getting bigger and bigger every day is the value of human smuggling. And with that said, I am right before the checkpoint on US 90. So the smugglers are bringing them here, dropping them off, and they're coming through my property. And that in turn has caused lots of heartache for us. Not to mention they're tearing down our fences. They're coming to our houses at night. I have a daughter I won't let walk on the driveway, you know, to jog or exercise because of this without having a dog with her. You know, we're kind of being left down here, and the Border Patrol's, their hands are tied. I mean, they're working to keep unaccompanied minors under control in a facility. They're not out here in the field when I need them. They can't come because they're so stretched out. You know, we're overwhelmed. I mean, we've been thrown to the wolves here as far as I'm concerned.
So the key point here is so much emphasis on border security and immigration policy and the effort by the White House to say this is just the normal seasonal deal at the southern border.
It's all about the weather.
And it isn't. And that needs to be punctured. That's where the focus should be.
Can you imagine living like that where you can't let your daughter out on the front porch or on the driveway unless she has a dog with her?
John Sewell also did a little comparison. What was it like for him and his family under the Trump administration versus what has it been the last 7 or 8 weeks?
I have very little confidence in anything that we're doing right now. You know, at least in the prior administration, we had a plan. We had something in place that was at least controlling the issue, and they knew what was going to happen to the individual once they were apprehended. Now, we have no plan. We have no direction. Where are we going? I don't think anybody knows that answer. Do you guys?
We know that 3,000 are going to Fort Bliss in El Paso.
Yeah, more than
3,000 teenagers, and the ones, and they're already full in Dallas at that convention center. They've reached a maximum capacity, and now they're going to take over some barracks in El Paso.
Report this week, more than 16,000 illegal alien minors are in CBP and HHS custody.
Mm-hmm. And 500 more come every day, folks. So I don't know what we're going to do.
Speaking of that custodial arrangement and the kids, the question was asked again about the press access to these border detention facilities that the left likes to decry, except when they're operating them. And this is the Biden answer on that.
I will commit when my plan very shortly is underway to to let you have access to not just them, but to other facilities as well.
Be able to have access to the facilities. We've obviously been allowed to be inside one, but we haven't seen the facilities in which children are packed together to really give the American people a chance to see that. Will you commit to transparency on this issue?
I will commit to transparency, and as soon as I am in a position to be able to implement what we're doing right now.
And that was Kristen Welker from NBC, and the reason they allowed NBC's Gabe Gutierrez the night before to go to a HHS facility, which was clean, not overrun. There were teachers there. There was soccer. It was very nice. But that's not the realistic reality of what is going on right now.
Yeah, that's the point.
They chose the nicest, cleanest place, and she wants to get into the other places.
The point is, what was his answer? His answer, I'll let you in as soon as we implement our plan,
which means
I'll let you in as soon as we
clean it up.
Clean up what's going on there, and that's not transparency, is it now?
No. And the nice place that they went to had 776 kids, and 110 of them had COVID that they know of so far.
On another matter we need to get to here, and this is the filibuster, but the filibuster with respect to particular issues, top of the list, H.R. 1, the left's desire to federalize elections so that the 2020 election becomes the election protocol and paradigm in perpetuity in the country, taking away essentially states' rights when it comes to the administration of elections. This against the backdrop of Brian Kemp in Georgia signing that election reform bill that we've discussed here that expands early voting, make IDs required for absentee ballots, eliminates the signature requirement, so on and so forth. We'll get to the particulars, but again, just in terms of the whole thing being scripted, both sides of it, the press corps and the president. CBS White House correspondent Nancy Cordes, listen to how this question is put to the president.
Republican legislatures across the country are working to pass bills that would restrict voting, particularly Democrats fear impacting minority voters and young voters, the very people who helped to get you elected in November. Are you worried that if you don't manage to pass voting rights legislation, that your party is going to lose seats and possibly lose control of the House and the Senate in 2022?
What I'm worried about is how un-American this whole initiative is. It's sick. It's sick. Deciding in some states that you cannot bring water to people standing in line, waiting to vote, deciding that you're going to end voting at 5 o'clock when working people are just getting off work, deciding that there will be no absentee ballots under the most rigid circumstances. It's all designed, and I'm going to spend my time doing three things. One, trying to figure out how to pass the legislation passed by the House, number one. Number two, educating the American public. The Republican voters I know find this despicable. Republican voters.
Angry Joe.
The folks out in the outside this White House. I'm not talking about the elected officials. I'm talking about voters. Voters. And so I'm convinced that we'll be able to stop this because it is the most pernicious thing. This makes Jim Crow look like Jim Eagle. I mean, this is gigantic what they're trying to do. And it cannot be sustained.
Okay.
I'm do everything in my power, along with my friends in the House and the Senate, to keep that from becoming the law.
I'm sorry, but who is Jim Eagle?
Not familiar with Jim Eagle.
Nobody is, because Jim Eagle doesn't exist.
I don't know. Yeah, that makes this look like that. He or his scriptwriter needs work on their similes. But a couple of things.
Issue. Yes.
Eliminating voting. Till 5 o'clock, limiting voting to 5 o'clock before people get to work. The Georgia bill, which is what he's referencing,
right.
I assume it's the only thing that's fully formed and was sitting on the governor's desk, signed by Kemp yesterday. 3 weeks of early voting, starting the fourth Monday before the election. Voting hours for 8 hours, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on weekdays, and up to 12 hours of voting, with polls open as early as 7 a.m. and as late as 7 p.m. during early voting. That is voter suppression?
You need an ID for absentee ballots, and there's going to be less drop-off boxes.
Yeah.
That's part of it.
And
I don't feel like that's voter suppression, do you?
As Karl Rove pointed out, if this is racist, then blue states, New Jersey, Virginia, and California are racist. They're suppression hotbeds as well. New Jersey requires a driver's license number, the last four digits of a social, for online voter registration. Virginia requires both a photo ID and your social security number. California requires an ID to register.
Racist.
Why aren't they racist? Is that voter suppression? Is that trying to eliminate reduce the number of young people or minorities that vote? It's ridiculous. And so was Nancy Cordes's outrageously phrased question. You know, around the country, Republicans are trying to suppress the vote, trying to limit people's voting rights. No, they're not.
Shame on her.
It's ridiculous.
All of them made me sick. He made me sick, and the reporters made me nauseous yesterday. The way they phrased every question was just, you know, complimenting him first, bashing the Republican Party, getting their narrative out, and then waiting for an answer.
That's
and
right.
Not even doing follow-ups.
And on the filibuster, you heard, well, here's what he said on the filibuster and the push. I mean, the press is more aggressive in desiring to blow up the filibuster than he is.
So the best way to get something done, if it holds near and dear to you, that you like to be able to, anyway, we're ready to get a lot done. And if we have to, if there's complete lockdown and chaos as a consequence of the filibuster, then we'll have to go beyond what I'm talking about. Our preoccupation with the filibuster is totally legitimate, but in the meantime, we got a lot we can do while we're talking about what we're going to do about the filibuster.
And he later agreed with a reporter who suggested that it is a Jim Crow relic.
Yeah.
Although he resisted making another Jim Eagle reference, which I appreciated. Ben Sasse reminded, you know, Ben Sasse, I know he's not a popular in Trump world, but when you're right, you're right. He reminded people on the Senate floor this week of Biden's hour-long 2005 speech defending the filibuster on the Senate floor. If there's one thing in this country stands for, it's fair play, not tilting the playing field in favor of one side or the other, not changing the rules unilaterally. We play by the rules, and we win or lose by the rules. Part of his defense for the filibuster 16 years ago as a United States senator who had been there for, you know, more than three decades at the time. And now he's sort of slow walking and, you know, don't make me do it ing the elimination of the filibuster that the radical left, who he is servicing, want. And he is using as sort of a bargaining chip, I think, with respect to H.R. 1, perhaps with respect to some sort of Green New Deal as well.
And yeah,
that's where people should be paying real attention.
I believe we should go back to a position of the filibuster that existed just when I came to the United States Senate 120 years ago.
Yeah, meaning you have to stand up there and speechify to, you know, run out the clock on legislation rather than the just announce you're invoking the filibuster and then you don't have to speechify.
You came to the Senate 120 years ago.
That's the, well, right, I know. He's trying to be cute. And he failed. But this is the slow walking that I'm referencing. Teresa on the north side.
Good morning, Amy and Dan. You know, that press conference was both embarrassing and sad at the same time. One reporter asked him about the shootings and gun control. He never answered the question.
He started talking about infrastructure.
He went right into infrastructure. It was like, whoa, where are you going? You know, and as far as the border, Biden passed it on to Harris, which should tell you something right there. And he has no idea how to control the crisis he created, so he passes it on to Harris. I mean, this is just a complete disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And then when asked how are you going to, because he brought up the thing that, you know, kids are crossing the border with numbers on their arms.
Yeah, he's got the phone a friend program.
Yeah, and how he's going to connect parents with their kids
has to happen. There have to be some certitude that this is actually mom, dad, or whomever. And there's ways to do that. There's ways to do that, a little bit like determining whether or not you got the right code for your credit card. What was your dog's name?
Mm-hmm. Well, when member of the cartel has a gun to mom's head and says, tell him your dog's name, so they return the kid, or they don't return the kid, tell them you're not the mom so that they keep the kid.
Right.
Whatever. I mean, the whole phone tree as policy to deal with this surge at the border is ridiculous. It's a cartoon. Greg in LaGrange.
Hi, good morning. I was shocked. I was shocked yesterday at how bad it was. And two things. If you wanted to split this country any more than it's already split, I don't think yesterday could have been a better example of that. It was completely something out of history. And the other thing is, you know, this H.R. 1 and H.R. 5 that's coming down the road, that's the Rubicon. Every state legislature should be pushing back through their media to get out their message on how he was wrong. I mean, he lied so much. It was pathetic. I can't defend the Republicans in every situation, and I won't. I certainly won't. But what he said yesterday was such a complete perversion of the truth, and to have him get away with it is just, I've never seen anything like it in my life.
Me neither.
I've only read about it in history books. Thank you.
Greg, I was going to tell him about this lady that wants to meet him. We have a listener who wants to meet you, Greg, but we'll talk about that later during Open Mic Friday.
Okay, we'll have to get Greg back.
We have to get Greg back on the line.
See if he's,
we have a love connection for you, Greg.
Yeah.
One of our listeners wants to meet you.
He's single and ready to mingle. Bill on the Northwest Side.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I have a few points. I'll go through them quickly. I was wondering if you're aware of any state that concludes its election day voting at 5 p.m. It's the first I've ever heard of it in my whole life.
No, it's not happening going forward either in these states that are moving or have moved legislation. It's just more fabulism from Joe Biden, who is a professional prevaricator, and he's not particularly good at it.
I mean, he just made it up, in other words?
Yeah.
He made up that Trump took away beds. He was just falsehoods everywhere.
Corn Pop told him.
Yeah.
Well, and Biden kind of sidestepped what I thought were the most important facets of, a potential voter fraud, such as voter registration, whereby you don't have to produce any identification. You check a box on a checklist attesting that everything you've written down is true without showing any proof. I mean, that's an invitation to fraud. And he didn't mention that. There's also the signature efficacy software that's set at 25% efficacy rather than 100%, so that basically an illegible scrawl in the signature box of a voting ballot constitutes a legitimate signature.
Well, this is one of the reasons why Georgia got rid of the signature requirement, so you get rid of everybody having to try to be a handwriting expert.
If software is doing it, it's just another invitation to fraud. I mean, Biden didn't touch on any of these points.
Wow.
And last but not least, and, you know, one of the ones I think is the biggest one, I thought the entire purpose of early voting, which generally lasts like 2 weeks or longer, is to eliminate the need for crowded polling places on election day. And why did we even need to automatically mail out ballots in any state? If there's 2 weeks of early voting, people have 10 days, other days, besides Election Day, to get their butts to a voting poll and vote in person and show identification. And Biden didn't mention that either. What is wrong with that? That's why early voting exists.
Thanks for the call, Bill. And in the Georgia reform legislation signed by Kemp, 3 weeks of early voting, as I mentioned, but just for emphasis. You're not allowed to bring water to people waiting in line. God. Like that, this is something like they're crossing the Sahara to vote. It's so ridiculous. What people do in line is you see it all the time. You see it from that alleged federal criminal who was a former state senator from the Western Burbs, Tom Cullerton. You get in line, you know, everybody waiting in line, and here's a sandwich, and here's something to drink, and don't forget to vote for Tom Cullerton or some other criminal. So that's why it's like cheap electioneering. And he knows that. Look, here's the bottom line with Joe Biden when it comes to H.R. 1 or the filibuster or immigration policy. he is not somebody who acts in good faith. So you can't have a conversation about why didn't he say this and doesn't he recognize that. He's not particularly bright and he doesn't act in good faith. That's Joe Biden. And that's what you saw on display yesterday.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, speaking of politicians who aren't particularly bright and don't act in good faith, we are still taking suggestions for renaming the title given to members of the Chicago City Council. Not aldermen, alder is what one alderman proposed. Guyberg in Lake Forest.
Aldermaniacs.
Thanks for the call, Guyberg. Aldermaniacs, not bad.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Crisis in the city of Elmhurst.
Oh, no. What happened?
A gentleman who owns a dry cleaners put up a sign 5 months ago. Trump wins two signs. Trump wins 70% of the vote, over 400 electoral votes. And the other sign, pray for the removal of demonic Chinese influence in our country. How do you read that? Pray for the removal of demonic Chinese influence in our country. What's your default on the reading of that sign? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. What is it?
Pray for the demonic removal?
Pray for the removal of demonic Chinese influence in our country. How do you read that sign? How do you understand it? Is that an example of Chinese bigotry? He's saying Chinese people are demonic? Is that what you think?
You said that, I think their leaders in China are demonic and communist. And you pray for that they have healing, that they become a democratic country.
Right. You see, that interpretation is when you're a person who is not looking to jackpot your neighbor. When you're a person who's willing to give your neighbor the benefit of the doubt, you're not running around waiting to deploy your moral panic against someone. But that's not the case in Elmhurst, at least not as it pertains to Terry Litovitsky. He has since put Terry Litovitsky, who adopted a Chinese girl, and her daughter confronted the owner of that dry cleaners about the sign. He subsequently put up two new signs. His new signs, only God is the ultimate judge of hearts and minds. And in a previous sign displayed 5 months ago, I apologize for using the wrong word. It should have said Chinese government, not Chinese people. Although he didn't say Chinese people in the previous sign.
No,
he said
he didn't.
Chinese influence. But if he's essentially saying for people who interpret it as Chinese people, I was talking about the Chinese government, the Chi-Coms.
Right.
You know, the people that are presiding over a genocide of
Muslims,
minorities in their country. Well, that's not good enough for Terry Litovitsky, Elmhurst resident. There is a protest planned outside Dulles Cleaners in Elmhurst this Saturday from a sign he posted, that sign, 5 months ago. And yes, after he apologized for not being more precise with his language on the sign.
It was just utterly, like, shocking to me. Like, it just was very upsetting, and I didn't really know what to feel in that moment.
Lily Melvin says she can no longer stay silent after a racist, anti-Asian sign posted in the window at Dulles Cleaners in downtown Elmhurst went viral this week.
I just didn't know that my town and people could have, like, thought that something like that was just okay to put up.
Dulles Cleaners owner John Dulles says the sign that called Chinese people demonic has been down for 5 months, taken down after Melvin and her mom, Terry Litavsky, confronted him in person.
I'm not a racist. I didn't, as I say, the sign, I made a mistake 5 months ago in saying, instead of saying Chinese government, I said Chinese people. That was a mistake. I admitted that. I took the sign down 5 months ago.
Now a new sign with an attempted apology is up in its place after pictures of the original resurfaced online this week.
Someone's trying to smear me and make me look like a racist. And when the lady or daughter came in, I says, okay, I'm taking the sign down. I tore it down, threw it in the garbage.
So you wrote it, you read it, you printed it, you hung it, but you didn't mean it? Yeah, I don't buy that.
Terry Litavsky adopted her daughter Lily from China when she was 2 years old. She's now 21.
It's not acceptable today, tomorrow, anywhere, anytime. But here, I never thought I would have to be doing this for my daughter.
It was amazing to just go in and confront him and tell him how I felt. Even if he didn't apologize to me, I wanted him to know and see my face and how I reacted to that.
That family saying this apology just isn't enough.
That apology enough? Was it even warranted in the first place? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
She should want the same thing. She's from China, to pray for the removal of demonic Chinese influence. Shouldn't she want the same thing?
Yeah,
now, what is wrong with people? Don't they have anything better to do with their lives?
The people looking to jackpot their neighbor. What about those people? And what about the people who repeat the charge they level without thought? Like that fungible ABC affiliate reporter, anti-Asian sign, calling Chinese people demonic. No, that's one read on it. That's a read where you're not giving the person the benefit of the doubt, the read where you're giving the person the benefit of the doubt. He's talking about the Chinese government. He is talking about in the context of an election. The sign next to that sign was a prediction about the outcome of the 2020 election. So he just was attacking Chinese people willy-nilly. Does that seem the most likely description of what was happening there?
And what power she felt as she described how it was so amazing to just go in there and confront him and tell him how I felt.
Well, that's the daughter.
I know. Well, she's 22. She's an adult.
Oh, I understand. Apology's not enough.
Protest
in front of his cleaners, Dulles Cleaners in Elmhurst, this Saturday afternoon.
Wasted energy. Instead, they should be protesting and trying to get back in-person learning Monday through Friday.
Well, okay. Terry Litavsky and a handful of fellow Elmhurst Herodians are going to be in front of Dulles Cleaners on Saturday. What would you say to them if you showed up? And maybe you will show up. I'll tell you what I'd say, but let's hear from you first. Joe in Franklin Park.
So, you know, I think that sign is, you know, we're against the Chinese government with stealing patents, cheap product, getting steel into the market. You know, all these things that the Chinese government has done, not recognizing Taiwan. There's so many things.
I don't know. One child policy, genocide. I mean, let's start
killing
at the top.
Killing Muslims. Yeah.
But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. And for this woman to take that out of context, especially when it was corrected, it's pathetic. This woman is such a loser. My God.
Thanks for the call, Joe. The Elmhurst Chamber of Commerce and Industry has
What's their statement, Dan?
Dulles Cleaners is not a member of the Elmhurst Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and the business owner's anti-Asian signage stands against the inclusive beliefs of our chamber and the Elmhurst community. By the way, the Elmhurst, the goons at the and cowards, synonyms. At the Elmhurst Chamber of Commerce, we're also aghast at
Sean
from Almond Park's Biden voters not welcome sign in his cigar shop just down the street in Elmhurst. Will and Skokie.
Hey, you know, it's basically the rise again of the Karens, of the people, particularly women, although I'm not trying to be sexist here, who, you know, will complain about everything just because they're offended. I was pumping gas the other day. I was 22 feet away from this other woman. She starts yelling at me because I'm not wearing a mask. And she goes on about how she's a nurse and this and this. And I, basically, the way I deal with it, I just looked at her and I laughed and I just ignored her. And that makes them all the more pissed off. And that's really what you want to do, is you just want to learn, teach them that they will just be ignored. It's like a child throwing a temper tantrum in a grocery store.
That's exactly like that. Thanks for the call, Will. Here's the problem is we don't indulge children throwing temper tantrums.
No, you just ignore it.
We do indulge Terry Litvisky. And those ghastly leftist housewives or professionals, like Will was describing. And it's not just those individuals. It's also a bunch of biological males whose balls never dropped in places like Elmhurst.
Don't feed into their drama.
And Hinsdale and Naperville and suburban America.
Those balls haven't dropped.
Isn't it? So what do you say to Terry Litvisky and her daughters? Her daughter's perfectly lovely. I feel sorry for her daughter because why? Because she was adopted by Terry Litvisky and raised to be focused on her non-behavioral trait, the fact that she's of Chinese extraction, focused on that exclusively and looking to be a victim. This whole Asian-American hate sweeping the country stuff, good piece over at realclearpolitics.com, Leanne O'Neill, she's a communications consultant in Houston. She's a Korean-American. She was interested in, is this really happening? I'm Korean-American. The idea someone might randomly attack me at the gym or hurl racist invectives to me at me at the grocery line makes me uneasy. So I looked at the numbers being used to support the so-called surge in attacks. A report by the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism drew national attention for identifying a 149% increase in anti-Asian hate crimes in 2020 compared to 2019 in 16 of our largest cities. That's a startling number until you realize that a big jump in a small number gives you a small percentage but doesn't tell you a whole lot, does it? The actual number of hate crimes in those cities, and by the way, the hate crime designation is pretty expansive. It can be a word, not just a, you know, it's not limited to deeds. You don't have to attack anybody. You could just call them a racial epithet, and that's a hate crime. Startling number until you learn, as she writes, that the number of hate crimes recorded against Asian Americans in the 16 largest cities, 2019 to 2020, went from 49 to 122 in a country of 330 million people. Some context here. In my hometown of Houston, there were three last year. The year before, there were none. Three. Some context is important because it keeps your feet on the ground so you don't become a raving hysteric like Terry Litvisky in Elmhurst. What do you say to her? What do you say to her when you see her or somebody who fits that behavioral profile? Mary Ellen in Crete.
Hi, you guys. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, Amy. First of all, yeah. I agree with you. That woman has too much time on her hands. She lives in such an insular world that she doesn't really know what to say. All she wants is her own, what is it, minute of fame. That's mm-hmm. all she cares about, at the expense of a gentleman who, first of all, like you said, Dan, put it on... put the sign up, you know, in context with the election last year. And then he apologized. He meant the Communist Party. He didn't mean the Chinese people. I listened to Dennis Prager, and he does remind people it's not the Chinese people, it's the Communist Party.
Yeah, no, thanks for the call, Mary. Is that required? When I talk about the Irish in Chicago, you think I'm talking about every person of Irish extraction in Chicago? Or am I talking about Irish political crime bosses, Madigan, Burke, Cullerton, Daly? Of course you know who I'm talking about because you put it in context. Because we're having a conversation. It's unmistakable who I'm talking about. I'm not making a general comment about Irish people or people who have of Irish descent, obviously. And neither was Mr. Dulles, that dry cleaner's owner. It's absurd. It's ignorant. And it's tolerated. It's amplified. Why? You want to know why the purge is winning? Why this identitarian nonsense is ascendant everywhere you turn? Is because of responses like the Elmhurst Chamber of Commerce. Is because Terry Litvisky backs you down. Why? How can you let her do that? She is a sad little person. And she is a sinister person. She is treating her neighbor unfairly at the outset. I'm not giving my neighbor the benefit of doubt. In fact, I'm looking to jackpot people.
Yeah, they're actively looking for people to take down and destroy. It's a sport for the left.
It's predation. Why does a small percentage of the larger public brainwash with this identitarian poison rule the roost? Because nobody stands up to Terry Litvisky. And that's exactly what you should say to her when you stand up to her, as I will if I have time to make it over to Dulles Cleaners on Saturday at Elmhurst. Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. You know, I wonder if this woman's daughter was educated or if Ms. Litvisky took the time to teach her about what really goes on in China and where Mao Zedong learned his philosophy from, Stalin and the rest of the commie dogs in Russia. You know, if she could come within 7 million people of how many people that guy murdered, starved to death, and so on, it would be an absolute miracle.
Well, yes, but thanks for the call, Greg. But that's not the case she's making. I'm not saying she wouldn't defend Mao or the Chinese or she even understands any of it. I'm just saying that's not the argument. The argument she's saying is demonic Chinese influence meant Chinese people, not the Chinese communist government.
Right.
And that the apology isn't good enough. Even when he comes back and says, I was imprecise with my language, I should have said government, so you didn't think it was people. Still not good enough. Why is it not good enough? Is there hate in his heart that Terry Litvisky sees that others don't? Does he have that third eye to know when there's hate in somebody's heart? Is that right? Why does Terry Litvisky get silence in response to her barbarism? That is the question you should be asking. Why do you let sentimental barbarians with their tears and ignorance destroy your neighborhood, business district, community, school, business? Why? Mike on the South Side.
Good morning, guys. Listen, it's no great revelation that the media has been, you know, adversarial towards the American people for a long time now. But it wasn't until 6:14 a.m. on this day that I actually became afraid of them, because the narrative they're now pushing is pro-China and anything to do with, you know, criticism of China, even when it's not criticism of the Chinese people, is going to be used against America. It's terrifying, and you scared me this morning. Thanks.
Well, they did the story because it fits the narrative, you know, of Asian Americans being under attack, and look at this agitator here at Elmhurst. So it fits in nicely in the A block. That's why they did the story.
Yes, because they're sentimental barbarians too. Who's going to stand with Mr. Dulles this weekend in Elmhurst? Anybody?
I would.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. You can win $12,000 towards the purchase of a new car or to cover your existing car payments just by doing acts of kindness. Learn more at 560theanswer.com/kindness.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and so it begins. New York Times reporting that Rutgers University is saying students must be vaccinated in order to return to campus.
Mm-hmm.
what begins at Rutgers spreads through the Big Ten faster than COVID.
Still having a hard time believing that they're in the Big Ten, but yes, they are a part of it.
Spreads through the academy, spreads down to K through 12,
yeah,
spreads
sure.
to your ability to move around the country, your ability to go to work. This is just beginning now, the vaccination requirement to
yeah.
resume life.
And Governor Pritzker said, you know, the vaccination passport. Now, what he's, do you guys, you have to listen to this, what he's doing. He's saying, well, we're not going to force it. You know, you can have an app on your phone. That's good. But places that you go, they may require it. It's private businesses. So now a restaurant might become a private business and demand that you have a vaccination before you get into the restaurant.
A restaurant is a private business.
Right. But he's anywhere you go. So if you want to go to a concert and you don't have a vaccination, well, that venue might not let you in.
Well, that's a private business decision, right?
Right, yeah.
The question...
So does it look like he's making us have a vaccination passport? But if you want to move around freely in the country, you're going to have one.
Well, we don't know that yet.
Well,
But to the question about some sort of app that allows you to show people that you've been vaccinated, there's nothing wrong with that. If it's your choice...
Mm-hmm.
As long as it's your choice, right? And if people ask you to show that for a particular venue, a private venue, they have the ability and right to do that. You don't have to show that to them. You don't have to be to go to that venue
yep,
or be engaged in that activity.
So what's your point?
The point is
it has nothing to do with Pritzker. Until and unless, stop overstating the case. There's no need to overstate the cases. It's a private business decision. Until and unless politicians move legislation to impose public mandates on private businesses, then there's not much to talk about. Because I respect private property rights. I don't know about you. Isn't the problem in this country we don't have enough people who respect private property rights? I don't have to agree with what somebody does on their property, but I'm not going to treat a private property owner the same way I treat an elected official making policy. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by Martin Kulldorff, who is a professor at Harvard University Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital. Professor Kulldorff, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
So Professor Macri over at Johns Hopkins has had a couple op-eds in the Wall Street Journal over the last few weeks, most recently suggesting that what he suggested in his previous op-ed seems to be tracking, which is herd immunity in the country by the end of April. So if we're going to be at herd immunity in the early spring, whenever that may come to pass, then is it judicious for private or public institutions to be running around mandating the vaccinations in order to access their spaces?
Vaccine passports are a very bad idea for a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons is public health, because public health is based on trust between the public and the public health officials. And if you try to coerce people into getting a vaccine, there's going to be more vaccine hesitancy and reluctance to get the vaccine. And not just the COVID vaccine, but other important vaccines like the childhood vaccines for measles or polio. So it's counter-effective to try to do vaccine passports because it will make people more hesitant to get vaccines. And for older people, it is very important to have a vaccine for COVID because that's very high risk. At the same time, there's absolutely no public health sense for somebody who have had COVID to need a vaccine because they are immune from having had a natural infection. So
But how long does that immunity last, or do we still not know?
Well, we know it lasts for at least a year, so we know it's good protection. It might not last for a lifetime. And it's unlikely, I think, to last for a lifetime because that's the case for other coronaviruses. But even if it doesn't last forever, the second time you get it, you would typically get it more mildly. For vaccines, we have even less information. There we only know that it lasts for at least a few months.
Right. And we know from, more than 30 million cases, confirmed cases, that the reinfection rate is nil. Don't we?
It's very, 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 very low. And when there is the reinfection, it's usually a mild infection. So one is very low, and two, it gets very mild.
And with respect to the vaccinations and these requirements, they're starting to do research to make, well, to essentially see if, I'll take them in a neutral fashion, see if the vaccine is safe for populations that are open question at this point, pregnant women as well as newborns. And actually, Brigham and Women's Hospital, along with Massachusetts General, participated in a study of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. And the report out yesterday was that these vaccines are effective in pregnant and lactating women who can pass protective antibodies to newborns, according to this research published in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. I know, you know, anecdotally, and there's been some coverage of this, too, that women who are pregnant or want to get pregnant are a little reticent because of the lack of research about the impact of the vaccine on the ability to bear children. Does this research that was out yesterday address that question fully, in your estimate?
No study ever addresses every question fully. But to date, we don't have evidence that there is a problem with the vaccine for pregnant women. At the same time, most pregnant women are young, in their 20s and 30s, so they are not at high risk for severe COVID. They can get infected like anybody else, but they're not at high risk for COVID, neither for themselves or their child. So they are not a high priority group to get vaccinated.
But here's the line that's coming from essentially the lockdowners, is that the Western civilization now rises or falls with the vaccine hesitant. Doesn't matter your age, doesn't matter your health status, you know, in terms of pre-existing conditions or no pre-existing conditions. If I don't go get vaccinated, or if somebody half my age in their 20s doesn't go get vaccinated, then we're doing a disservice to public health, and we're impeding a return to a pre-COVID normalcy.
No, that's too dramatic, far too dramatic to put it that way.
Yeah, but I mean, in Illinois, if Dan and Mike Scott, those guys don't get vaccinated, my kids can't go back to school Monday through Friday, regular school like it used to be, according to our governor.
So why is that statement too dramatic? The one you just heard, as well as mine.
Well, first of all, there's absolutely no public health reasons to keep schools closed. It hasn't been any time during this pandemic. Children can get infected, but their risk of from COVID-19 is much less than from the annual flu, and we don't close the school for annual flu. Also, children do not infect others in a very high amount, so when school teachers get infected, for example, it's typically from another adult. It's not from their kids. So this the school closure, I think, is the single biggest mistake during this pandemic. It has devastating consequences on children, especially working-class children whose parents can't afford to put them in private schools who have been open, or in pod schools or tutoring. So there's absolutely, absolutely no reason why all children shouldn't be able to go back to 5-day in-person schools on Monday. If we take Sweden, for example, which was criticizing for its lax approach, wrongly so, I think, Sweden kept schools open during the spring, during the height of the pandemic. So all 1.8 million children ages 1 to 15 were in daycare or school, and exactly zero of them died from COVID. There were only a few hospitalizations. And school teachers were actually at less risk than the average of other professions. So unlike influenza, schools are not a place where COVID transmits and drives the epidemic. So there's absolutely no reason to keep any schools closed during the pandemic. And the same is true for universities. And actually, closing universities has the opposite effect, because if you close universities, then the students go and live with their parents, who might be in their 50s or 60s. So they are sort of medium risk, instead of being at campus where they interact with other students their own age who are very low risk. So closing universities has actually the opposite effect on disease transmissions and was a stupid mistake being done. So the thing to do is if teachers are 60 or above, then you should let them teach from home online. But school should be open with all the teachers less than 60.
Provide some context for us with respect to the coverage of COVID variants. There's another story out yesterday. Grave concerns over new ultra-infectious, quote-unquote, COVID variant found in Papua New Guinea. You know, the argument is being made, and it was made in Bloomberg just earlier this week, that we're never going to go back to a pre-COVID normal because we're never going to achieve herd immunity because of these variants. And we're just going to have to sort of learn to live under these COVID protocols.
Well, probably the person misunderstands what herd immunity means. COVID will always be endemic. It will never go away, just like the previous four coronaviruses. But we will get into an endemic state where it's not a big problem. And will be less problem than, for example, the annual influenza seasons. As all viruses, there are mutations, so that obvious it has been from the very beginning. The fact that some variants come up, which might be has a slight advantage in transmission, is not a surprise, but that doesn't change the optimal strategy, which is to protect those that are a high risk vulnerable with vaccines and other things while letting most people live normal lives. So if you've had the disease, you still have immunity towards new variants. And depending on the variant, it might not be complete, but you have protection against severe disease, even if you get a mild cold. So the idea that these variants are some kind of a scary monster coming to take us, that doesn't make any sense from any epidemiological or scientific sense.
Yeah, but Professor, why do you think that this was blown so grossly out of proportion when you compare it to H1N1 and those other forms of COVID?
So that is a political question, and I'm just a simple scientist. So as a journalist, you probably understand that better than me, because to me it's stunning.
Yeah, it's also stunning to you what's been happening to some of your colleagues, some of the people who were like the most respected epidemiologists in the world until they decided to take a contrary position to the politicians and journalists and some others. Tony Fauci, of course, Saint to Tony Fauci. You wrote about this in The Federalist. It's important. I mean, you're one of the co-authors of the Great Barrington Declaration, along with other respected men and women of science who you write about here from Stanford and Oxford and elsewhere. And this is a concern not just for the careers of these outstanding intellects and academics, but you raise the issue. It's a concern for the pursuit of science more generally.
Yeah, I think that's true. And if you read the media, you get the impression that they cite the experts who are in favor of lockdowns. But when I talk to those infectious disease epidemiologists that I know personally, the majority, not 100%, but the majority are against lockdowns and in favor of focused protection. But the majority do not dare to speak out because of the attacks that has been thrown at those of us who do speak out. And for example, in my view, the most preeminent infectious disease technologist in the world is Professor Sunetra Gupta at Oxford University, and she has been completely trashed in the UK media for speaking what I think is just common sense when it comes to infectious disease technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I assume you've been disinvited from a lot of Cambridge cocktail hours on Zoom over the last several months as well with the statements that you've made on the topic.
Well, as a single father, I haven't had time to do those cocktail hours even before the pandemic.
Good for you.
You're not missing it. Yes. Yes. Very good. Martin Kulldorff, he's a professor at Harvard University Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital as well. Again, co-author of the Great Barrington Declaration and one of the infectious disease experts who has spoken out from the beginning, like you just heard him here, with common sense and science and context, and has been very helpful in elucidating these issues for the public. Professor Kaldorf, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, both of you. It was a great pleasure.
Yes, thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, we were talking vaccinations and other COVID-related topics with Professor Martin Kaldorf from Harvard. And I think based on what he offered, you understand why he's at Harvard. I wanted to share some audio I exclusively was able to obtain of Governor Spaulding's vaccination.
Oh, yeah. Excuse me. He got the J&J vaccine yesterday or 2 days ago in Springfield.
Yeah.
The fairgrounds there where he broke his femur.
Right. So this is Governor Pritzker and the medical professional who administered the shot.
Nothing more I would say really than a little prick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely a prick involved.
Yes, there is a prick involved.
Yeah, there's one prick involved.
Yeah, I would say there is one prick involved.
I agree. I'm not a doctor, but I agree. There is one prick.
Oh. Yep.
Real tension between...
Yeah, the more I look at this, I think this is pretty minor.
Yeah, real tension between those two. But there definitely was a prick involved in Pritzker's vaccination.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I know the Biden press conference was dominated by immigration and the filibuster and the implications of the filibuster's continuing existence on H.R. 1, the federalized elections legislation. But I want to focus on something he said before the Q&A. Because of this piece at blog. This piece that a teacher blogged, talking about after 2 days back at work this week, I have now taught each of my five classes in person for the first time in a year. What's happening to America's kids? He said, I taught a higher math class of almost exclusively college-bound students that he hadn't taught until today, even during the hybrid model. He went on to say, look, we got 50 minutes versus the 90 minutes under the all online classes. So I need you to watch this instructional video before class so we can get right to it. It's a higher math class. These are college bound students. It's only 50 minutes. We need to get right into practice problems. Nobody watched the video. I wasn't going to reteach the material in the video, so I would incorporate as much instruction as I could. Not long after I started in, I stopped. They were just staring at me. Mm-hmm. He said, like children of the corn or something.
Yeah.
Are any of you going to write any of this down? He asked. A few reached for pencils and notebooks. I continue my instruction as I want to do when I'm teaching. I frequently stop and ask questions to check for student understanding. And so I did. I asked a student a question. The student just stared at me.
Oh, my God. I feel that pain as a coach right now. Ooh.
I looked at the student for a moment and then said, you realize I can see you, right? You're not hiding behind a screen with your camera turned off. I said it with a hint of humor, but the dark truth is there. These kids have no idea how to be students.
They don't.
They've completely forgotten. I know 374 days has passed since the last time they were in school, but these college-bound students had been in school for several years before. None of these students is a freshman. They have forgotten how to be students.
They forgot how to interact with each other, too.
And he goes on to say that this partly explains their low grades. They don't engage. And I'm not the only one seeing this. He had a conversation with one of his vice principals, and that administrator said he's talked to other teachers who describe the same phenomenon. That's what they do. They stare.
I'll tell the girls to get in spiking lines, and they just stare at me. And I go, guys, what is going on here? We've been practicing for 3 weeks. It's the strangest thing. You have to deprogram them. I don't know how to do it. I'm struggling.
He describes again, they stare, they sit, and they stare. It's the strangest and scariest thing I've seen on a large scale in all my years of teaching. And so against the backdrop of that reality, anecdotal as it is, but serious, and certainly the academic performance is not anecdotal because there's been a number of studies on it dating back to last spring. This is what Joe Biden says about K-8 education.
I also set a goal before I took office of getting a majority of schools in K-8 fully open in the first 100 days. Now, thanks to the enormous amount of work done by our administration, educators, parents, local state education officials and leaders, recent Department of Education survey shows that nearly half of the K-8 schools are open now full-time, 5 days a week for in-person learning. Not yet a majority, but we're really close, and I believe in the 35 days left to go, we'll meet that goal as well.
He's celebrating that? In Europe, they're all open and have been since August.
The only ones left supporting school shutdowns or hybrid learning or acting with torpor in returning to school are the teachers' unions, their acolytes, and the politicians they own.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this is the issue that should have dominated the press conference, well, and should dominate the national dialogue right now until there is a remedy for it, because you can't, unring this bell. You can't go back in time.
But not one reporter there who was called upon, who was on the list, asked about schools. It was deplorable.
For more on all topics covered, including the one I've struck upon, pleased to be joined again, weekly hit with Brett Baer, Fox News anchor, special report, 5 p.m. Chicago time, of course, during the week, and also the author of the number one bestseller. Of course, it's a number one bestseller, but Brett Baer wrote it. 3 Days at the Brink, FDR's Daring Gamble to Win World War II. Brett, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
What about that? I mean, you're the father of young kids, and I can't believe what we know about K-12 education, what we know about the safety, what even the CDC and Tony Fauci have said, and still we have this just inexplicable incrementalism from the President of the United States and his party.
Yeah, I think that was a major drop of the ball by not asking COVID questions specifically on schools after what the president said in that opening, and also what we've seen from the administration and kind of protecting teachers' unions in a lot of those jurisdictions. I mean, the CDC comes out with these new guidelines saying social distance from 6 to 3 feet in schools, and the teachers' union says, you know what? We don't think we agree with that.
Yeah, we don't believe you. Like, they're putting their lives in danger.
It used to be follow the science. It used to be follow the science. But now here's the science and scientists saying 6 to 3 feet for kids in school. And the teachers union says, no, we don't think so. So that's a major, major problem. And just personally, my kids are going back to in-person, but they've been like hybrid off and on. And my 10-year-old son says openly, he says, Dad, I just don't do well on this, staring into the screen. He said, I really, really do better in school. And, he articulated that, but his teacher said the exact same thing.
Wow. This whole thing, I mean, we're going to look back on this. I know this is, a trite, we're going to look back on this and, but this issue, you can argue about the extent of business restrictions and capacity limitations and so on and so forth. What we have chosen to do, because that's what it is, we have chosen to do with K-12 education in this country, combined actually with the curriculum, which is a whole nother kettle of fish, but related, is just criminal. And there is going, we talk about reckoning with our profligate spending. There's going to be a reckoning for what we have done over the last year and what we're continuing to do in some jurisdictions with respect to kids' intellectual development.
Well, I mean, listen, the parish I belong to, it's in Bethesda, just outside of D.C., also runs a school. Mm-hmm. And the Monsignor who oversees all of that said that they're applications are through the roof. They never stopped in person, never once stopped They had about 1 week at the beginning, but then were full on back, and they mitigated the issues, did it themselves, and they figured it out. And a few Catholic schools in the region are doing that, and you can't get in
right,
because the applications are through the roof.
Well, the rise of school choice could be the silver lining. That is true. So we'll stop there on a positive note. With respect to the filibuster, let's talk about the filibuster a little bit, because Joe Biden, as Ben Sasse recounted this week, a big fan of the filibuster not so long ago, not so big a fan now. Now it's a relic of Jim Crow, and he wants to slow walk.
Jim Eagle.
Not Jim Eagle, or it makes Jim Crow look like whatever. And now it's something he wants to slow walk away by going back to the, you know, you have to read the telephone book for 24 hours if you want a filibuster. But what is the real play here? Is that his way of saying, Republicans, you better work with us on H.R. 1 to come up with something, or I'm willing to go with my leftist friends and eliminate the filibuster?
Yes, I think that's exactly what it is. And, you know, once you go down the road that it's racist, pretty tough to walk back from that. And the other thing is it's racist, but Kamala Harris used it against Tim Scott's crime reform bill just a few months ago. And Democrats had the most use of it in the past year. So, listen, I think they're hinting that there will be changes. I think they're going to test it with a number of pieces of legislation, and that big one is the voting rights, where, you know, frankly, this is all about taking the moment, consolidating the power. You know, this is what the state issue is about D.C. and Puerto Rico. This is what, you know, the voting rights issue is, and I think that they see an opportunity here, and they're not going to let it pass, even though the sound bites are just rich of defending the filibuster and the rights of the minority.
Now, I know a lot of people watched in horror at that press conference yesterday, the fact that he had a list of reporters. They knew, you know, who they were going to call on before they even began. But was this press conference a setup to implement the 25th Amendment?
Oh, I think that's a stretch. But he's listen, he had a couple of times. I said yesterday he ran into a rhetorical cul-de-sac and couldn't get out. And, you know, other presidents have had lists of reporters, but we've not seen, you know, like a briefing book by subject where at times he's reading directly from it on the issues of foreign policy. It was almost like turn to the page, you know, and just read the graph. And that's different than what we've seen.
Yeah. Actually, we see it here with Cook County Board President Toni Preckwinkle. She can't read. She can't answer a question that's not scripted. Nobody seems to be so concerned about that here in Cook County. And I don't think actually that many people are really concerned about it with respect to Joe Biden. I think this is bait, that the chum that the left puts out there. They want people to go hysterical about his mental acuity. The same way, frankly, that I think Trump made a strategic error when he focused on that in advance of the first debate, lowering the bar, taking the eye off of the substance of what Biden is the vessel for. And that's what we're doing again, rather than talking about the substance in some quarters of what he said yesterday on policies that impact people's actual lives. You get people playing the cheap game of, you know, is Biden going to make it to the spring? This is the 25th. I mean, isn't that a ruse from the left, or at minimum, aren't they enjoying when the right chooses to go down that path?
Yeah, 100%. The bar is so low that if you come out and make it through, you're a winner. And that's a big expectations game. I think you're right on the substance and the policy. We should look closely at it. I mean, he said they're not going to make the May deadline of getting troops out of Afghanistan, but by next year, he can envision American troops in Afghanistan. Significant policy issue. Says North Korea is the number one foreign policy threat, but they haven't talked to North Korea, haven't even managed to, and it's not going well as far as that outreach. And I think really the biggest one was the filibuster and a kind of a change in how Joe Biden looks at that. And I think progressives are licking their chops, saying this is the moment to go big. And the fact that Joe Biden met with historians and talked you know, at length about FDR and kind of changing the paradigm, as he said yesterday. Those are big phrases that mean, you know, big things. And he has to have the votes, but he's definitely swinging for the fences.
Well, and the other thing he did on immigration, which was a dominant topic, was essentially saying, you know, this is just a seasonal thing. No big deal. We'll let you into the facilities once we've cleaned them up. Then you can look around once we think it won't look bad for the administration. That's our definition of transparency. And unfortunately, because Steve Ducey wasn't one of the reporters that got to ask a question, everybody else is the
Peter
same.
Ducey.
Peter Ducey wasn't one of the ones that got
Steve
to ask.
Steve would ask.
Yeah, right. But either Ducey. But everybody else is just reading from a script effectively as well. I mean, when he said, oh, this is the same thing happened under Trump. Oh, wait a second. Excuse me, Mr. President. Illegal apprehensions at the border, people trying to get in this country legally, was up 3x in February. Year over year. So it's no, this isn't just seasonal. No, something different is happening here. I'm not saying it. The Mexican president is saying it. The El Salvadoran president is saying it. I mean, come on, letting him get away with that is malpractice.
Yeah. And then when he says the vast majority of families are being turned back. Well, no, 13% was the number.
Right.
As far as the ones going back and the ones staying. Yeah, I mean, it's provable. The data is there that what he's saying about just seasonal, it goes up and goes down, that's not the case. I mean, it's exponentially more than it has been, in part because the message went out. And, you know, it's the people wearing Biden T-shirts that are coming that are talking to reporters on the border.
Brett Baer, Fox News anchor, special report 5 p.m. weekdays, Chicago time. Number one bestselling author of 3 Days at the Brink, FDR's Daring Gamble to Win WW2. Brett, thanks as always.
We'll see you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, among the many questions not asked, the topics not covered. Mr. President, how do you respond to the 14 states that have filed suit against the federal government for your cancellation of oil and gas leases on federal land affecting somewhere between 250 and 400,000 jobs potentially if those lease cancellations are kept in force? Oh, that wasn't asked.
No.
It should be because energy policy is important for our economic vitality. It's also at a macro level. It's also important for the economic vitality of energy sector workers at the micro level. And that latter topic is one covered by Vince Bileski in a piece of RealClearInvestigations.com worth checking out. Vince is a former senior editor at Bloomberg. He's written about the tension between the green jobs and the blue collars, and he joins us to discuss. Vince, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You offer a good anecdote about, you know, the promise, the marketing of the green jobs that are going to be there for those displaced by the cancellation of the Keystone Pipeline and the cancellation of these leases potentially and so forth. At least that's what the administration holds out as a promise. But, you know, the reality on the ground, how those promises are or not fulfilled, how the sector actually operates can be a little bit different than the dreamy picture that is presented by the Biden administration.
That's right. The country is going through a transition on production of electricity, and that's ramping up. And so we'll be losing fossil fuel jobs, particularly beginning with coal. Those jobs are already going away for coal miners and workers in coal-powered power plant. And the new jobs that are being created in wind and solar are primarily construction jobs. And the point of my article is that the new jobs coming around are not as good as the jobs we're losing. And there are several reasons for that. And when I say they're not as good, what I mean primarily is that They don't pay as well. They don't come with the same benefits, and they're not long lasting. And so the country, as it goes through this energy transition, should pay a little more attention to what we're doing with the men and women who are actually building tomorrow's energy future. My story focused on examples of wage theft, where workers will build these massive complexes called wind farms and sometimes not get paid for them because subcontractors do devious things. This is a problem in the industry. Safety is another problem in the industry. Building a wind farm is a dangerous endeavor. It's as dangerous as it gets. These are windy areas and big parts being, you know, swung around by big cranes. And I documented at least 8 deaths in the wind farm construction industry. So the Biden administration needs to take a look at this. States that regulate, have some power over regulating how the industry operates, also needs to take a look at this. States like Minnesota have done a good job in seeing that local labor plays a big role in the construction of these projects, and that usually means it comes with some protections. But it's really interesting. A lot of today's energy sector, big wind and solar projects are being built by out-of-state labor. What we have is a nomadic workforce traveling the country, building these projects. And once they're built, they require virtually no labor to operate. So it's an issue, and I think the country needs to take a closer look at it.
Well, in your article, you featured, you know, workers who came from Texas, Michigan, and other states. They traveled to central Kansas. And what happened to those people?
Well, what happened to those people is that after working for several months on this big project run, you know, owned by one of the biggest utilities in the country, the subcontractor that they work for, and that's how these big projects are built, there's different levels of companies involved, ran out of money and could no longer pay them. And that issue went all the way up the chain, and the owner of the project is also not paying them. So we have about 100 workers that are owed in total over $100,000, several hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they're not going to be paid unless they can win in court, which is always difficult. So these are some of the just unfair labor practices that are going on today, kind of under the surface of our transition to green energy and clean energy, which is important in many levels. But we're not paying a lot of attention to the people we're asking to actually construct this. Think back what happened with coal miners many decades ago when coal mines collapsed. And it took a long time for those industries to figure out how to turn those jobs in, you know, very dangerous work into jobs that could support a family and that Americans could be proud of. We're not there yet with the renewable energy sector.
Yeah.
And it's an
Yeah. It's a surprising industrial policy, and the central planners don't have it all figured out, and they just throw money at the direction of something they wish would happen. And you have a bunch of rent seekers pop up out of nowhere to build windmills. It's a real surprise, not to anybody who's passed an Econ 101 class. But I also would suggest that, of course, technology is going to push the energy sector to evolve like every sector. However, like this transition to green that's so inevitable and sort of the vision that the Biden administration has and their acolytes, I'm not so sure. As Mark Mills points out, Mark Mills, who's a fellow at Northwestern's McCormick School of Engineering, you know, canceling the Keystone Pipeline didn't eliminate oil use. It just shifted where it shipped to and how it shipped somewhere else and more expensively. And so, yes, if you can make the price of something artificially high enough to decrease demand for some legitimate, reliable alternative, perhaps you can expedite the transition. But, reliable is a big problem when it comes to renewables, or as some energy sector analysts call them, unreliables. So, this transition, they think, is going to happen so seamlessly. And I'm not saying you do, but the way they talk about it is it can just happen so seamlessly, and it won't grind up a bunch of people's jobs and household income in the process, not to mention the impact it'll have on changing the climate, if any? I mean, these are all very much open questions.
You know, they're challenging. They're definitely challenging situations, and it can be addressed on the state level. It's not really primarily energy policy is set at the state level, and around the country, states are doing various, making various moves. If you look at Arizona, traditionally a politically conservative state, but it has recently set itself up as a leading state to push solar power and has committed to having a 100% clean energy by 2050. Now, why you talk about economics 101, why is that the case? It's because solar power has become the cheapest form of power in the state of Arizona. And why is that the case? Because it's always sunny in Arizona. And so what's interesting about this transition is it's going to be state by state, and yes, different states will have different challenges. Ohio, a state very close to you, has a completely different set of situations, and it has been resisting the move to alternative power, partly because it can't do so as cheaply as it can continue running its gas and nuclear power plants. And so states like that, you'll see a, you know, bigger battles, other issues being raised during the transition. And I think it's important for your listeners to keep in mind that the renewable energy that's being built, it's not going to supply 100% of America's electricity by 2050 or in the future. What we're going to end up with is a much more diverse mix of sources. Nuclear power is going to be with us for the foreseeable future, as will natural gas. What's really happening is the alternatives will be taking the place of coal. And, you know, that's as much for economic reasons as climate change reasons. Coal has just become more expensive to produce coal power. And so the economics is really driving this. And underneath the economics is, do you have a lot of wind or sun in your state? And so, you know, the Midwest has a fair amount of wind. Different states are different. I'm from Michigan, and Michigan went through a very big wind development stage in the last decade. So it's an important story that will be affecting consumers and workers, and we'll be hearing a lot more about it.
No question, and this is why the conversation should include sort of what you were touching upon. I mean, I agree with you that the mix of energy will be more diverse than it is now in terms of the percentages employed to deliver the capacity required to power the world's largest economy. And so the question should be, so who drives that distribution of participation? Is it going to be central planners and the rent seekers, or is it going to be, you know, more market oriented? And also, too, the promise on the climate change piece. I mean, yeah, I understand Joe Biden thinks all West Virginia coal miners should learn to code. But here's something. Cancellation of the Keystone Pipeline. China is building coal plants that equal about 20 Keystone pipelines. So if this is a global issue, you don't have participation from China and India and a lot of the developing world, then what you think you're doing and what you're actually doing are two different things. And it leads one to question the motives of people who are promising things that are going to be very difficult to deliver, particularly when politicians promise something, you know, 15 and 30 years out, which is always, you know, a bit of folly, isn't it?
Right. We need to pay attention to what's happening in the next 5 and 10 years. And so long-term promises are just that, just long-term promises. China is a really interesting situation that the world obviously needs to keep its eye on, because on the one hand, you're absolutely right. They're going through a massive build-out of coal-fired power plants right now. At the same time, they promise in about a decade's time to pivot very aggressively to renewable energy. And by 2060, admit no more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And the interesting thing about China is its ability, because obviously it's a central planned economy, its ability to move rapidly in one direction as opposed to the other. And so it's claiming that it will be able to pivot very quickly. And so it's made more aggressive promises than the United States has made at this point. Now, again, as you point out, these are just promises. And I think what we need to do is keep in mind what's happening at the state level, wherever you happen to live. And in some states, green energy is more expensive. In some states, it's less expensive. And that really is pushing the needle on which way to go. And you have to understand that we're in places like Arizona, where you save on your electricity bill, your monthly bill, because of solar power, that's a good thing.
Oh, yeah.
It's a good thing that we don't have to mine and do extractive processes if you can just get it free from the sun. Why not exploit Mother Nature? At the same time, when those workers in these states are losing their jobs, I think it is a good idea for state governments to take a look at where these workers can be replaced. And it's never a seamless process. I grew up, in Detroit near the auto industry, and we saw what happened to the auto workers over the last 30 years. It will be messy. That's the way capitalism moves. But I think it can move more smartly, and that's what my story was about. We don't have to dislocate entire regions just to get to where we want to go economically. We can think more smartly about how to plan these things. And it's not so much central planning. It's often done simply through tax incentives. So the
that's a form of central planning. I mean, preferred tax treatment is a form of central planning.
Well, it is a central policy, a federal policy, but keep in mind what's happening now with the coal industry. So the big initiative coming out of Joe Manchin, who is, you know him as the senator from West Virginia, very powerful Democrat right now, and a very big advocate for his coal communities in West Virginia and in states like Pennsylvania and Wyoming. They're pushing something called carbon capture technology.
Yeah, right.
And this could be a very important development if they can bring the cost down. And basically what we're doing is grafting technology onto coal plants and natural gas plants to keep them around for a lot longer. And if it works, it's going to be really important for both the state, for the revenues in these states, for the local communities to have jobs. And the reason that it's rolling out today is because of tax incentives that's going to help it, develop in ways it needs to. So tax incentives, and we have to remember that the oil and the gas industry also receives tax incentives.
I know. It's a problem. It's a problem across the board. That's my point. I mean, I'm not ideological about sources of energy. The climate apocalyptics and the lobbyists are, and the preferred tax benefit, the tax benefits, preferred tax treatment, all of these various energy sectors get. The best thing to do to make sure you get the mix that is optimal is remove them all and let market viability dictate energy mix. How about that concept that very few people talk about?
Well, there's certainly the market needs to be driving the bus here. At the same time, the bus can go off the road. And I think we saw the bus go off the road in Texas with the issue of the grid. And of course, Texas is a deregulated energy market. And essentially what happened in Texas is that the market forces did not protect that grid and that power structure from cold weather, even though there were, economic incentives to do that, which is the fact that if you do that, you will eventually, draw more customers and create a more secure energy sector in the state of Texas. So it's a complicated energy.
It is complicated. And so is the Texas failure.
And you need to be smart. And I think the smart approach has been in various states that have been able to look at the situation and discover that, why are we building more coal? This is, again, I'm taking you back to Arizona, and this is a very recent story. I encourage your listeners who are interested in this topic to Google, energy and Arizona, and to see what that state has recently done, which is they've discovered that just let the sun power the homes, and they can do so reliably and save everybody some money. In other states, that's not possible, or it's going to cost them more. And so I think if you break this up and let the states drive the buses, you're going to get a more precise and smarter energy policy emerging. And that's what the country is grappling with right now, is what to do in various states that are struggling with this.
He is Vince Bileski, former senior editor at Bloomberg. Check out his piece, realclearinvestigations.com. On the climate front, tensions where green jobs meet blue collars. Vince, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, NASCAR and its iRacing platform to unveil a Chicago street course. You know, it's a video game. That runs through Grand Park and just north of Soldier Field for the NASCAR iRacing Pro Invitational Series.
Do they have to try to go real fast so they don't get carjacked?
Yeah, right. And it may be something where NASCAR ultimately does a street course for the actual racing. We already have a NASCAR event every day in Chicago, a street racing event called the Dan Ryan 500.
Exactly. Oh, my. I hate going on that thing.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Finally, somebody picked up on my line of argumentation against all of the protestations of love and protection for the Asian American community. I'm talking about from the left, the hypocrisy there. The academic left in particular, how they profess love and practice hate when it comes to Asian Americans. Wen Kong Fa is a attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. And he tackles this in an op-ed he wrote for the Journal. Schools offer empty words to Asians, reminding people what I have reminded people of on this show.
Yep.
Harvard President Lawrence Bacow, an attack on any group of us is an attack on all of us and on everything we represent as an institution. To Asians, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders in our community, we stand together with you today and every day going forward. Virginia's Fairfax County Public Schools proclaimed that anti-Asian hate impacts our students, our colleagues, our families, and our community, and promised to, quote, address misinformation and xenophobic language, unquote, that promotes exclusion of Asian Americans. Yet, as Mr. Faw properly recounts, these schools and many others discriminate against Asian Americans in their admissions policies. The practice is couched in doublespeak about diversity, equity, and inclusion. But you can dress it up however you want. When you're artificially lowering the character scores of Asian Americans trying to gain entrance into Harvard because you have too many, quote unquote, Asians, I don't know what you call that other than
discrimination, because that's what it is.
And let's not forget, let's not leave out New York City Mayor Warren Wilhelm either. Remember, he objected to the specialized schools such as Stuyvesant, Bronx Science, Brooklyn Tech, the composition of their student body, too many Asian Americans. And it was he called that a monumental injustice, quote unquote, changing the admissions policy to make it harder for Asian American students, many from low income families, to get into those schools, even though they would have on their merits of the academic record. So, I mean, there's just one aspect of the conversation about the mass shootings in the last week. Obviously, this specific to the one in Atlanta and also the one in Boulder, Colorado. So that is an issue, the race hustle by identitarians. Guns are an issue. And so is the psychology of these mass shooters an issue and the prevalence of mass shootings. Are we really seeing a spike? We talked about this earlier in the week. In the wake of that awful mass shooting in Boulder, Colorado, where the gunman killed 10 people. Let's talk about the psychology piece of this a little bit more with Christopher Ferguson, who's a professor of psychology at Stetson University and the co-author of Moral Combat, Why the War on Violent Video Games is Wrong. Professor Ferguson, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on this morning. I appreciate that.
Well, you wrote a piece that I actually referenced in our conversation earlier in the week. So since it's your work, I'll expropriate it. I'll let you claim it again, reclaim it for the purposes of our conversation. And part of this is looking at the incidence of mass shootings and whether or not we're really seeing a statistically significant spike, or that this is something that's been relatively stable, even though it's still terrible, obviously, but over an extended period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, the evidence we have is that mass homicides have remained actually fairly stable over time. And I think, you know, part of the confusion with this is there really are two different terms in play, but they kind of mean slightly different things, and that's the terms of mass homicide and mass shooting. So with a mass homicide, you have three or more individuals who are killed as part of that that shooting. And so if we kind of define it very clearly as that, then and we exclude certain other categories like gang violence, terrorism, and things like that, then very clearly these incidents have remained stable over the last few decades. What happens with, you know, some of these narratives is we have this other category of mass shooting, which just means that a gun was fired multiple times in a public area and, you know, three or more individuals might have gotten injured. With that term, what you tend to see is that certain crimes move in and out of different categories. So what was considered gang violence 10 or 15 years ago is now being moved into this sort of mass shooting category today. And if we're looking only at news article coverage of these things, it's easier to track news articles covering this term that are more recent versus 10 years ago or 20 years ago. So that can kind of give the illusion of an event that is happening more frequently, even when it is not necessarily. So the reason that there's this perception that mass shootings are increasing over time, which is also probably not true, is just the sort of fluidity in the way that the term is being used and how certain crimes are being moved from one category that used to be what people were concerned about 10, 15, 20 years ago into a new category that people are concerned about you know, today. But well,
how would you categorize this? We had a birthday party on the South Side last night. 8 shot, 1 killed. Is that a mass shooting?
Yeah, that would probably be the way that the term is being used today. But there again, that particular crime can probably fit into multiple categories. So I don't know the specifics of that particular shooting and what the motivation may have been. But if it had been gang related, you know, it would have be considered gang violence 10, 15 years ago. Now the sort of trendy, and I use that term very specifically, you know, the trendy type of crime is mass shooting. So people will sort of move it into that category today because that's what news media is concerned about. That's what people are concerned about today. So that's one of the things we have to be a little bit careful about when we talk about crime trends, is sometimes certain types of crimes can fit into multiple categories depending upon, you know, how you define things, what people are concerned about at any given time, and that can really distort our perceptions of crime. The good news is that gun violence overall has been down over the last 25 years. It looks like it went up again in 2020 for a lot of different reasons, but generally speaking, gun violence has been declining over time, not increasing.
And one of the other areas we need to be careful of is ascribing motives to mass killers we wish they had that they may not have necessarily had, and this has been part of the controversy surrounding the massage parlor murders in Atlanta.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, so what happens, again, with these high-profile crimes is that people very oftentimes try to fit them into a social or political narrative by ascribing cause or ascribing motive. In some cases, even before the details of the crime are known. We also saw that in the Colorado shooting where sort of initially people assumed that he was a white male. It turned out he was a Syrian-American individual. Individual crimes are being sort of crammed into a political agenda. We saw that with serial murder back in the 70s and 80s when there was a national conversation about pornography and people were trying to ascribe pornography to sex crimes. We saw that with mass shootings 20 years ago with violence in video games. And now we're still seeing it with mass shootings around, of course, gun control, but also issues of race and misogyny. And so on and so forth. And a lot of these are important topics. I'm not trying to put down the validity of some of these issues that people are worried about, but it can be very difficult to try to take one particular crime and look at sort of these idiosyncratic, unique aspects of that crime and try to make some larger social statement
Well,
rather than looking at what the commonalities are across all of these mass homicides.
Right. And you also, I believe, made the point, too. I mean, in terms of the racial composition of these mass killers, basically, it's about what the racial representation, mm-hmm. racial distribution of people in larger society is. So it's not, you know, it doesn't really comport to the it's white supremacists run wild argument that some have made.
Absolutely. That is absolutely correct. Yeah. Yeah. That is one of the sort of common myths I see, you know, particularly in certain, you know, internet communities and such, is sort of the idea that, you know, all or almost all mass homicide perpetrators are white males, or that they're, you know, connected to some kind of race ideology. And, you know, and certainly that is the case for some, you know, shooters. But generally speaking, the ethnicity or the race of mass homicide perpetrators is about equivalent to the underlying racial demographics of the United States. And most shooters are not particularly ideological. You certainly do find some that are, that may, you know, have connections with hate groups and stuff. But most mass homicide perpetrators are, you know, they're mentally ill, they have antisocial personalities, and they tend to view themselves as victims of society at large. So there really isn't this sort of general ideological, you know, commonality across these shooters, whether we're looking at race or gender or other things. They're angry, usually chronically mentally ill individuals who, you know, eventually reach a point where their life is over in their own minds, and they want to punish those they think that are responsible for that.
And what about, you know, speaking of mental illness, that also something is not something that is uniform across all of these killers. And sometimes it's not present at all. It's just a grievance or a lack of self-control, or some would argue, I would argue, you know, that if you believe evil exists in the world, it's just unadulterated evil. But we always want to say, well, this person had this affliction, or this person had that event, or this person is an incel, and this is what's responsible. The problem is, as our friend Theodore Dalrymple, a former prison psychiatrist himself across the pond, points out, is the problem of making sweeping generalizations about one profile, even multiple profiles that are similar, is you have a whole bunch of other people that fit that same profile that never commit an act of violence. So there may be a loose correlation, but that is not the same thing as a definitive causation.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. You know, so again, if you kind of look at this very specific category of your mass homicide perpetrators, then you do tend to find that, you know, chronic mental illness is fairly common in that population, combined with the antisocial personality traits and sort of perception of grievance. But you're absolutely correct. If you then, you know, sort of try to instigate some kind of like minority report type of, you know, let's
right.
test everybody, see who is chronically mentally ill, who has antisocial personality traits and is upset about how they've been treated in society. Yeah, that's probably tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people in the United States. And most of them, you know, have not and will not commit any major crimes. So, yeah, that is absolutely true for any kind of profile we can put together. We can look for commonalities between these individuals who commit these horrible crimes, but we also do have to recognize that there are many individuals that also probably would generally fit that profile that are otherwise law-abiding citizens.
Yeah, we always want nice and tidy solutions to these horrific events, responses to these horrific events, a policy that's going to make it all go away, and it just doesn't work that way. Christopher Ferguson, professor of psychology at Stetson University, co-author of Moral Combat, Why the War on Violent Video Games is Wrong. Professor Ferguson, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
I appreciate this opportunity to speak to your audience.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
I found a gym for you because I know you want to get fit and get back into fighting shape.
Uh-huh.
It's a gym that is doing exactly the opposite of what Krispy Kreme is doing. So Krispy Kreme, real quick, if you have a vaccination card, they'll give you a free donut for the next year. You can go every day, show them your vaccination card. And fighting back against that, because we're this all about health, right, and eating healthy and properly, a gym in, New Jersey is going to give you a year membership for free if you don't get vaccinated. They tweeted out, "We believe in health the real way, exercise, good diet, plenty of vitamin D, zinc, and environment to distress.
Not falling for that trap.
Why not?
I'll tell you why not. Glad you asked.
Because the average person, by the way, put on 2 pounds a month during COVID.
And the women love it.
What?
A survey by dating.com of 2,000 women.
Yeah?
Three quarters, 75% of singles are more turned on by a dad bod over any other body type, including a mate with rock hard washboard abs. Think paunchy and peckless. That's right.
What?
Singles are beginning to embrace more body types as they know the struggle of staying in shape during the pandemic. Dating.com VP Maria Sullivan said of this survey. So, hey, I'm not joining a gym. I'm not getting in shape because I'm going to give the ladies what they want, baby.
Oh, no wonder people love Pritzker.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call in now! Open mic Friday!
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and it is Open Mic Friday, taking your calls, any topic you choose. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. And Amy, did you want to start with something, some rant against CPS? Or
no, I mean, it's just a horribly, disgustingly run organization, but and I'm a part of it, so that's what does that say about me. But tomorrow I'm getting arrested because I'm going to my son's football game. Okay, so I want to know who's going to bail me out. Are you going to bail me out, Dan?
You're not going to get arrested.
You don't think?
Chicago cops are not going to arrest you.
They better not. Well, what about security if they throw me out?
Well, you could get thrown out of the event, you know, and then if you start to use your, you know,
don't you know what?
Karate skills on them or something, then maybe it could rise to the level of arrest. If you just keep it peaceful, I'm sure they'll.
We're playing ITW Spear Academy.
I thought you were going to get a cherry picker and just sort of lord over the field.
That's for home games. This is an away game.
Oh.
So I got to check out, you know, if there's a hole in the fence, or I do have a ladder in my car because I could scale the fence and kind of sneak underneath the bleachers. Mm. But then I'm like, why sneak? As you say, I'd rather die standing than live on my knees. This is absolutely stupid. CPS football games are not crowded like suburban football games are. There's not the community atmosphere of support. And there's 10 parents who want to go to the game, but we could spread out in the bleachers. So let's exercise some common sense and let us watch our kids play football.
I also want to get the ladies' feedback on that dad bod survey. Make sure that that's accurate.
Oh, yeah.
That accurately reflects the distaff side's perspective on the issue. So take your calls on that. And speaking of protestations, we talked about earlier in the show.
Oh, yeah.
A protest 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. tomorrow, so 11 a.m. to noon, in Elmhurst, of this dry cleaner who put up a rather innocent sign that was taken offense to by some ghastly pea hat harridan in Elmhurst because she adopted a Chinese daughter. She adopted her daughter from China as a young girl and taught her how to be an itinitarian. And so this is a sign from 5 months ago that they're still trying to blister this hapless business owner in Elmhurst over. And we talked about, we can revisit the particulars, but the bottom line is it is totally without justification. Rich in Indian Head Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Like we discussed a little bit last week, how people are so offended by everything. This is another example in Elmhurst. Here's a guy that put out a sign, you know, where people said he was attacking Chinese people. And when he tried to apologize and verify that's not what he meant, they're still attacking him. They want to ruin this man's life. This is exactly what I'm talking about when people go overboard and don't listen and try to understand what he really meant. And one other thing I would like to say, if I can, is Joe Biden says this voting is sick, what they're trying to put forward. Well, isn't it our responsibility when we go out to vote to make sure that it's our vote that's being cast and it's not being stolen by somebody else? Thanks a lot, and have a good weekend.
Thanks for the call, Rich. Yeah, and Biden also said he has Republican voters' support for a variety of his positions. I'd love to hear from a Republican voter who supports Biden's promotion of federalizing elections or opening borders.
Yeah, that took me back, too, when he said that yesterday at the press conference.
Also unchallenged by
DC
Press Corps reading from their script.
And we have new voter rules here in Illinois. I mean, one thing, they're going to have ballot drop-off boxes in front of every polling place.
Elections in Illinois, I mean, you know, I hate to say they don't matter. At the state level, the local level, your local school board, your village board matter. Do state legislators, statewide offices matter anymore? I don't know. You know, North Korea has elections, too.
Mm-hmm. So is Russia.
Terry in Rogers Park.
Hey, I'd like to know why the Department of Education stopped teaching civics to elementary and high school students. I think it's because leftist leaders wanted to prevent our children from learning about the Constitution and how our federal system's supposed to work. And it also helps them prevent patriotism for the United States.
Thanks, Terry. They are teaching civics. It's just updated civics, redefined civics, action civics. We've talked about it in the show. You know, action or active civics, that's to turn grade schoolers into political activists. That's the point of K through 12 education these days. Why is that lost on anybody? Oh, by the way.
Yeah.
A homework assignment circulating at Loyola Academy in Wilmette. It's not the government school systems. The same school that bounced a baseball coach they were going to hire, George Kemper, we had on the show, for completely erroneous, illegitimate reasons about social media posts. It was ridiculous.
Stupid.
Here's the assignment.
Mm-hmm.
How do you benefit from white privilege, and how have you held on to that benefit despite knowing the harm it does? What have you learned about the ways you specifically wield this privilege that do harm, whether you intend it or not? Dig deep. No sugarcoating and no focusing on the good you have done with your privilege. Remember, this isn't about being self-congratulatory. It's about pulling out white supremacy. Loyola Academy in Wilmette. What have you learned about your white privilege that makes you uncomfortable? That I'm attending Loyola Academy in Wilmette. How about that? There's your civics, Terry in Rogers Park, and the rest of the listening audience. Loyola Academy, one of the great Catholic schools in the region, right? Right? Can I get an amen? Are you allowed to say amen? Or is it a woman at Loyola Academy? Uh-huh. Bob in Waukegan.
Yeah, I think we should designate the southern border as the Biden-Harris Autonomous Zone.
That's a good idea.
Well, like they had in Seattle, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got everything included there. We've got assaults, robberies, rapes, shooting, homicides. Antifa could be replaced with the cartels. We have gag orders on federal agents. We have the media can't get in to see anything unless it's antiseptically wiped. I mean, it works perfectly, the Biden-Harris Autonomous Zone.
I love it. That would usher in the Biden-Harris Summer of Love, just as it did in Seattle, right, according to outgoing Mayor Jenny Durkin. Very good, Bob. John in Libertyville. Hey, John.
John.
Hello, this is John.
Yep, you're on, John.
Nice to talk to you guys.
Yep.
I love your show.
Thank you.
Just wanted to give you a little chapter on the latest Biden privilege, where it just came out that Hunter Biden was involved in a little gun thing.
Yeah.
You know, since his dad was talking about enhanced background checks, Hunter's then-girlfriend, Haley, took his gun and thought he was going to commit suicide, so she threw it in the dumpster behind their high-end grocery store. The Secret Service was notified. They went to the store where he had purchased the gun, and the gun dealer would not give them the records because they're only privy to the ATF. A couple hours later, ATF was there. They gave him the records. Hunter had lied on the 4473 form that he had never done any drugs or anything.
Yes,
and correct. Which is a felony.
Yes.
And
Yep.
They did find the gun. A recycler, neighborhood recycler, had found the gun, and he turned it in. But, so I'm hoping that Dick Durbin, maybe when he bumps into Joe in the hallways in Washington, talks to him about this little problem with the gun and the background check for the smartest guy that Joe Biden knows is Hunter, right?
That is correct. Very good, John. Maybe Dick Durbin will make a citizen's arrest. What do you think? That is right. He apparently lied on the form. Are you an unlawful user of or addicted to marijuana or any of the depressant, stimulant, narcotic drug, or any other controlled substance? He was discharged from the Navy for drug use in 2013 and had constant addiction problems since that time, including since in rehab. He characterizes himself as an addict.
Yeah.
So Hunter Biden, pile up the potential felony laws that Hunter Biden has violated. But, we'll see. That's a question that could have been asked. It came out yesterday. Could have been asked at that presser.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't have time for it. Did not have time.
And Haley is also the Biden's daughter-in-law, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, Eduardo at Midway.
Yeah, Dan and Amy, I saw this article in the Tribune where there was racism towards African-Americans in the workplace, and even the kids were bullied. Maybe Mr. Biden and VP Harris can go down there and have a summit.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Eduardo. Rick in Downers Grove.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I want to ask you a question about voter fraud, but I've noticed before the break you were talking about Pritzker and his aide. And here's a little fact about Pritzker. If he was to be rendered down like they did Wales back in the whaling days, this country would be energy independent for the next 50 years. And as far as voter fraud, now, let's say somebody in the Biden campaign comes clean and says, yeah, here's how it happened, here's what we did, and there's no doubt about that Trump won, and there's no question about it. Nothing would happen. I mean, Biden wouldn't be removed from office. The things he's doing wouldn't be null and void. So I'm like, what's the downside to political cheating? I mean, is there any downside?
Well, that's a good question, Rick. Thanks.
Speaking of Pritzker, too, this might be kind of gross, but you know how we were talking about our friend Paul Bryan, how he lost 200 pounds, yesterday?
At least, more than that.
Or more than that, yeah. Well, he used, then he got, case of the giggles, he got his skin, he got the folds taken out.
Yeah, yeah.
And he donated that to wounded warriors that came back that needed skin grafts. So Pritzker could lose weight, do it for the greater good of society and donate his skin. Am I kidding?
Perhaps I didn't. Boy, that's something I hadn't
considered.
Well,
I mean, but you can donate that stuff.
If I was in need of a skin graft, I'll pass. I'll go with a charred skin or whatever affliction I was suffering from. No, thanks. No.
That took me back when I heard that from our friend Paul Bryan. I'm like, oh wow.
Yeah.
But he helped a number of wounded veterans who had burns and things, other things.
Hmm.
Okay, yeah, let's.
A lot to think about there. A lot to think about. James in Westmont.
I can think about it when I'm in prison tomorrow.
I'll help with your bail, Amy. Don't worry about it.
Thank you.
Oh, speaking of which, by the way, I didn't mention. Yeah. So the Dulles Cleaners in Elmhurst, 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., there's going to be some shrews out front protesting this guy. You can stand with the cleaner there too and tell her how offensive and small and despicable she is to be running around trying to jackpot fair-minded people. Or would she like to offer some sort of substantive defense of the Chinese communist genocidal maniacs? I just want to give the opportunity for people to rally to the defense of the business owner for a change. All right, I'm sorry, James, go ahead.
No worries about it. speaking of which, you're talking about school real quick. My son will be starting up right after spring break full time. Everybody all in.
Yeah.
So, which is a good thing.
Does he have to wear two masks, though, like they do in Maine Township high schools?
No,
two masks,
don't.
Or else you can't get back in. And parents are sitting down and taking that line of bull jive. They're not fighting back.
No, they sent out a survey because the seniors went back a couple of weeks ago, and they asked the rest of the parents, and they have well over 90% response. So it's all going to be in person, and those who have to stay home and with legitimate reasons, they could still do online if, you know, for the rest of the year, but at least they're going back.
Okay. All right.
But that's not why I called.
Oh, okay.
Okay, Woody.
All right.
I'm sorry.
Now that Amy's calling her call, let's go to your call, James.
Okay. I'm sorry. No, it was just with all the stuff again about, you know, the guns, and they want to ban assault weapons, quote unquote. I still want to start my own AR-15 support group. Dan, you could be a charter member. Amy as well.
Thank you.
I'll be a charter member. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Well, still, for all those who love their ARs and know the real reason what they are, when this thing gets started, it's going to be a big group. Everybody could join us, and we will just sit around with our ARs and talk about it.
Is it okay if I bring my MP Sport? I don't have an AR.
You could bring
can
anything.
Can I bring any rifle?
Can I bring my 38 Special?
Any rifle?
The band or the gun?
The girly gun.
You could bring anything you want, but it's mainly for, you know, the AR platform. Some people bring AK. That's fine. You know, whatever you guys have or want.
All right. Thanks for the call, James. You know, there's no need. There's no shortage of need for support groups in Chicagoland. No question. Mm-hmm. Glenn in Barrington.
Yeah. Hey, guys. Love your show, by the way. I listen every day.
Thank you.
Real quick comment. Peter Ducey, I like him. I think he's learning, and he's got a place in the future. However, I think the White House position is very senior level position, and he needs to be a lot more assertive and aggressive. I know he shouts at people, but he's going to get one shot at a comment, and it has to be good. And
I don't know if he'll ever get it. There's no guarantees that they'll ever call on him.
Yeah,
no,
they're not going to put Biden up there like they did yesterday again anytime soon.
Well, he's had the exchanges with Psaki. Thanks for the call, Glenn. Look, I actually think, you know, I was a little skeptical of Ducey because it's obviously a patronage hire.
Right.
I mean, it gives the appearance. I shouldn't say it obviously is, but it gives the appearance.
Yeah, he's a patronage.
But I think he's done a good job.
Yeah, he sure has.
You know, and I actually think being room temperature the way he's been, pointed, but very room temperature, as opposed to, you know, the melodrama of a Jim Acosta, I think that's been totally appropriate. I think it's a nice contrast where he's asking substantive, probative questions and not engage in any of the histrionics of the leftist clown show that punctuated the Trump administration. So actually, Ducey has exceeded my expectations. I think he's done a pretty good job. So there you go. Yehuda in Lincolnwood.
Hi, Dan and Amy. So, Amy, I have a solution for you. Bring a BLM sign and you won't get arrested.
There you go. Smart.
That is so brilliant.
Yeah.
I can take one from my church.
Wear
my
P hat, too.
Oh, I have one of those.
Yeah.
But
we spoke about voter fraud. There's no evidence of that. George Stephanopoulos has taught us that, right? There's no voter fraud.
That's right.
How can we say such a thing?
That's right. You're even just raising it and giggling like you did. You're perpetuating the big lie, Yehuda, and we just can't tolerate that. We have to cancel you. I'm sorry.
Thanks for calling.
Frank in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. A couple things. Pritzker's got to learn how to dress. I mean, he wears nice suits, but when he was getting his vaccine, he was in a very folksy shirt.
I love the short sleeve dress shirt. I love the horse puppy shoe salesman, hush puppy shoe salesman look. I think horse farm. So that's why I said horse.
Yes.
Hush puppy shoe
he's
salesman.
He's a billionaire. He's a billionaire. That shirt looks like he got it off the rack at the Five and Dime.
Oh, no, he's just like really us, man. He's one of us.
You know how much, you know what the textile cost was to construct that uniform for him? I mean,
guys, in his defense, he had to wear a short sleeve shirt because he was getting a vaccine.
Oh, you can't roll up your shirt?
You can't. No, I don't. You want to see that?
You can't disrobe? I would like to see it. Yeah, I'd like to see his thumb. I would.
Well, we get to see his thumb.
Other comment, I think Biden is faking some of this, to be honest with you. I don't think he's as senile as they make it out to be.
That was, well.
Oh, he's doing the Gigante play there? Is that right?
I'm not familiar with that one, but I mean, he's 78. You know, I just think he's playing it up a little bit. I really do.
No,
I don't
he's
think
not.
He's as,
yeah.
That was so uncomfortable to watch. I just
You're like so over the top, so far gone on this. It is just
so
lunacy. Wait, is that all you had, Frank? Just
no. Last comment was I'm waiting for the liberals to claim that this Suez Canal blockage is the cause of any inflation that we see in the economy.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, that's a perfect excuse for them when you really think about it. You know, they print all this money. They're going to create. You can see it in food prices. You can see it in other things.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to give them any ideas, but waiting for them to say, oh, it's the Suez Canal blockage. It's causing, you know, decrease in supply or whatever. It's causing prices to rise.
Yeah,
perfect excuse for them.
And you know what? That freighter that's blocking the Suez Canal, racist.
Yeah.
Racist.
I haven't gotten that one. I
Islamophobic. Right?
I guess.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Brad in West Loop.
Yeah, maybe you talked about it earlier, but the whole Sidney Powell defense of no reasonable person, I mean, I respected her and her reputation preceded her. What do you think about that?
Well, in terms of a defamation, thanks for the call, Brad. In terms of a defense of defamation, I'm not sure what. In fact, I think that Dominion essentially is de facto a public entity. So they have the actual malice standard. You know, I don't know all of what Sidney Powell has. I've read some of her court filings. But I will tell you, but so setting aside the defamation claim for a second and just going to her performance post-election, which is what Brad was speaking to, I will remind everyone that I gave her the benefit of the doubt. She's an experienced prosecutor. She represented General Flynn very well. So let's give her the benefit of the doubt. She is making some big claims. And I said at the time, big claims that she better prove up, because if she doesn't prove up, then her professional reputation is kaput. And I would say she did not prove up, and her professional reputation is kaput.
Yep.
That's what I would say about Sidney Powell. Chuck in Delavan,
Wisconsin. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, how you doing? I missed you guys last week. Couldn't get the number through. Hey, thanks for mentioning my garage band, Leftist Clown Show, Dan. Hey, I'm so far ahead of schedule, I got to tell you guys really quick. I fed my pigs already. I used some antiseptic wipes. I just came out of the outhouse.
What
I
about on
my
the
turban.
Pigs? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no. That. Yeah. Hey. You were talking about that girl thing. All girl things on dating sites. I knew this from years ago. You got to know how to dance, and if you don't know how to dance, then they know that you don't know how to do the horizontal bop.
Oh.
So that's You know. So anyway, get ready to plant your potatoes. Potato planting next week.
On Friday. I'm all over it.
By the way, Chuck, can I give you a little advice before you go? Can I give you a little advice, Chuck? Did Chuck leave?
Chuck, are you there?
Oh, he left.
Well, what advice? Tell us.
Well,
he's still listening.
You know, he was giving advice like if you can't dance,
you can't do
right,
the horizontal.
You're not going to, you know, woo the ladies. I would also say, Chuck, I mean, just to help Chuck out, if you refer to it as the horizontal bop, it also will not happen.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
You got a text about your Pritzker getting the lap band surgery, donating
the excess skin.
Yeah, this is from our friend Tom. My God, I just had to put down my pork rinds, which I believe is actually what Pritzker's skin is comprised of.
And my friend who donated his skin after getting the surgery and losing the weight, it went to the Army Medical Center, not to Wounded Warriors.
I'm glad we know where Paul Bryan's skin is now.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.